Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, everyone. Hope you had a great Passover and Easter weekend. And last week, I asked a question that we couldn't answer about the defining document so far of the 2012 election. In fact, it was a question that Congressman Paul Ryan couldn't answer about his own House Republican budget.
Are you willing to say that it would not only be revenue neutral?
It is.
But also distributionally neutral, which means that the wealthy aren't going to benefit and the middle class isn't going
to
suffer.
I don't know. There's no way to know the answer to that question. But we do believe in a progressive tax system. That's why we have two tax rates. 10% tax rate for low and middle income earners, 25% tax rate for higher income earners. Whether it's distributionally the same as the current code, it's impossible to answer that question.
Paul Ryan with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday on April 25th. Ryan is increasingly seen as the lightning rod figure of the presidential race and a likely Romney running mate. Now, today and tomorrow, we'll get two views of Romney-Ryan America versus Obama-Biden America. Tomorrow from Chris Hayes from The Nation magazine and MSNBC. Right now from Raihan Salam from National Review Online and Rupert Murdoch's iPad publication, The Daily. Hey, Raihan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
You wrote a piece in The Daily on Friday arguing that the Ryan budget is no more radical than the Obama budget, especially on Medicare, and we'll get to that. But regular listeners know that I've been a little baffled by Ryan's inability to answer Chris Wallace's question there about his tax rate. The idea is lower the top tax rate from 35% for the wealthiest earners, which it is today, to 25%, but close off a lot of deductions and loopholes to raise the same amount of revenue, as he said in that clip, revenue neutral. So if it's not an overall tax cut, if it doesn't shrink government, why go through the upheaval of rejiggering all the rates and deductions?
Well, the basic idea is that we have a lot of tax expenditures in the tax code right now, and these tax expenditures tend to benefit more affluent taxpayers. For one thing, a lot of taxpayers don't actually itemize because it's not worth it to them to do so. But when you pay a higher rate of tax, then those deductions really add up. So, for example, if you're making $500,000, the mortgage interest deduction might be worth much more to you than it would if you were making $50,000.
Were you surprised that Ryan, in that case, and I don't know what he said to other reporters who maybe have asked the same question, that he could not say whether this would redistribute wealth toward the top?
Well, it really does depend on which tax expenditures you wind up eliminating, which tax expenditures you wind up curbing. And the trouble is that there's actually a legislative politics issue at work, which is that Paul Ryan is the chair of the House Budget Committee, and he is not the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. He did, however, get all the Republicans.
Ways and Means Rights tax law.
That's exactly right. But he did get Dave Camp, the chair of that committee, and all of the Republicans on that committee to agree to his broad design principles. So the question is whether or not they're going to deliver on a tax code that is distributionally neutral and one that really does curb tax expenditures.
But why should working and middle-class Americans have faith that the Ryan reformulation wouldn't wind up as a redistribution of wealth toward those whose tax rates are being cut, that is, people who earn more money? That would seem consistent with the Republican philosophy.
Well, I'm not so sure that's true, Brian. I think that, well, here's the one thing that I'd say. I think that some people are criticizing Paul Ryan for saying, hey, let me put out the low rates without talking about the difficult part. Let's put out the candy without eating the broccoli of talking about which tax expenditures we're actually going to curb, because a lot of those tax expenditures are very, very popular. And I think that's a legitimate point. But I think what he was trying to do is say, hey, wait a second. There's a bipartisan consensus on the idea of curbing tax expenditures and lowering rates. We saw that in a variety of different proposals, including the Simpson-Bowles proposal. Now, granted, this is a somewhat different proposal, but I think that the idea is certainly very possible because people don't appreciate how much revenue we lose through tax expenditures for the affluent.
And that's a lot of tax deductions to eliminate if you're going to lower the rate for the highest earners by 10 points. and still make it all up to be revenue neutral. That, I presume, is why Democrats are skeptical that it really would be revenue neutral.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, because when you get rid of a lot of these tax expenditures, you suddenly start encountering very fierce resistance, for example, from the home builders industry. There are a lot of industries that really depend on something like the mortgage interest deduction, or rather, they think they depend on it. And so that transition from here to there is going to be a very difficult one that a lot of people resist very strongly. So that's where the politics come in, and that's where it's going to be a very interesting battle.
And when you talk about deductions, there are things that people see if they itemize because they take them, like the home mortgage interest deduction. But the biggest, what they call tax expenditure, from what I've read, is really the fact that ordinary workers at ordinary jobs with health insurance get those health benefits without being taxed on them as income.
Yes, absolutely.
And if that were to go away, then that would, you know, cause employers to wind up, or that would cause workers to pay income tax on their health benefits or some other thing to make up that amount of money. And that really would be a new tax on working Americans.
There are a lot of different ways to go about structuring that. So, for example, President Obama in his Affordable Care Act actually did curb that tax expenditure with his tax on high-cost insurance proposals. And there was also a proposal by John McCain in the last presidential election that was really embraced by a bipartisan range of policymakers and economists, which proposed having a flat deduction so that people would get the same deduction if you were affluent or if you were wealthy, if you were poor or middle class. Because the problem right now is that very wealthy people get much more benefit out of that tax exclusion than less affluent people. And if you evened it out, you would save a tremendous amount of money, but you would also create a more level playing field. And another view is that if you get rid of that exclusion, then, well, you're treating people who get employer-provided insurance the same as people who don't. And that could actually raise a lot of revenue, but also potentially restrain medical care costs over time.
Would the Ryan budget, as you understand it, raise taxes for those at the bottom if he's saying just a 25% tax rate and a 10% tax rate? Because conservatives in the media often complain that with the lowest 47% of earners paying no federal income tax right now, we are increasingly becoming a nation divided between taxpayers and tax recipients, as the rhetoric goes. Can we assume from that Ryan tax reform that it would ask more of the working poor and lower middle class under that theory?
Well, here's the thing that a lot of people find discomforting. We actually do not know until we know which tax expenditures are going to be preserved and which are not going to be preserved. So, for example, one man's tax expenditure is another man's noble social program. If you look at something like the tax preference for capital gains income, you could characterize that as a tax expenditure, or you could characterize that as a very sensible measure designed to encourage economic growth. If you look at the earned income tax credit that channels resources to poor families with children, you could describe that as the kind of tax expenditure we want to get rid of, or you could characterize that as the kind of social program we want more of. So much depends on those details about which tax expenditures are preserved and which are not. My assumption is that Ryan wants to preserve those programs that are benefiting poor and middle earners. But again, that's going to be up to the House Ways and Means Committee to some degree.
In your Friday article in The Daily, you refer to something Ryan said in that clip, that he believes in a progressive income tax. And you say, just like President Obama, who believes in a progressive income tax. But Ryan's two rates, 10% and 25%, would be very flat. Not progressive by historical standards, wouldn't it?
Well, I think the real issue is when you're looking at the distributional burden, and that sometimes – it can be sometimes a little misleading. So, for example, if you are someone who rents an apartment and earns a relatively high income in New York City, you're going to be paying a very different tax rate from someone who lives in, say – suburban Texas and who owns a home for a variety of reasons, because you're treated differently under the state and local tax deduction. You're treated differently under the mortgage interest deduction and many, many other things. So the thing is that those tax rates can sometimes be very misleading. What you aim to do by simplifying the tax code is to some degree make things more fair across those different taxpayers. You want to treat people with similar incomes more similarly than you do in a tax code in which you have a ton of different deductions.
Raihan Salam, my guest on WNYC, columnist at The Daily and blogger for National Review Online's The Agenda, as we talk about the Ryan budget, Romney's embrace of it, and the fall campaign. Tomorrow we'll get a politically different view from Chris Hayes of The Nation magazine and MSNBC in the same time slot. Now, it's an interesting moment as the fall campaign gets underway in earnest between Obama and presumably Romney. Each is trying to paint the other as radical while painting themselves as moderate. And here are a few seconds of each from last week saying, in effect, government versus free markets ideologue. Who, me?
I have never been somebody who believes that government can or should try to solve every problem.
Now, I'm not naive enough to believe that free enterprise is the solution to all of our problems.
But they also both went after each other's visions as dangerous and very different from each other. First, here is Romney.
President Obama and I have very different visions for America, both of what it means to be an American today and what it will mean in the future.
And here is Obama on Ryan's budget and Romney's embrace of it.
It is a Trojan horse. Disguised as deficit reduction plans, it is really an attempt to impose a radical vision on our country. It is thinly veiled social Darwinism.
And that's the line that is really stuck in the media, thinly veiled social Darwinism. You're shaking your head and grimacing. And it brings us back to your article on Friday, which says, if the Ryan budget is radical, so is the president's. How so?
Well, here's the thing. If you look at both the big driver of increased federal expenditures over the next several decades is going to be the expansion of the Medicare program. Basically, a lot of people tend to get much more in benefits out of the Medicare program than they paid into the system, in part because medical care cost growth is increasing really dramatically. And so the question is, how do you actually curb that growth over time? In President Obama's last budget proposal and in Paul Ryan's budget proposal, they both propose limiting the growth of Medicare expenditures to GDP plus 0.5%. That is the exact same growth rate.
In other words, it's a half a point higher than the growth in the overall U.S. economy.
Exactly. This is despite the fact that actually medical care cost growth has been actually a fair bit more than GDP plus 0.5% in recent years.
Hasn't it been like 5% more than GDP, 6%?
Not quite, and it's also varied, but it certainly has been quite a bit higher, and it varies from year to year, and there's been some more restraint in recent years than in the past.
Okay.
But so the core issue is that they're saying that we can't keep going this way. We can't keep growing the program at the rate of overall medical care cost growth. And there's one concern, which I think is correct, which is that the Medicare program itself and the way the Medicare program itself works might actually be exacerbating that cost growth. So both Ryan and Obama are trying to come up with ways, wait a second, how do we actually restrain that over time? And they basically have different ways of doing that. President Obama hopes to do that by having an agency called IPAB figure out smarter ways to pay providers and use that to restrain that cost growth. Whereas Paul Ryan is saying that, wait a second, let's use competition among private insurance providers and let's allow senior citizens who are beneficiaries of Medicare to make choices that restrain that cost growth.
So Ryan would turn Medicare into largely a voucher system where the elderly would mostly go out and buy Medicare coverage on the private market with a government subsidy depending on their income. So they would have incentive to hold down their own costs, while Obama would do it with this appointed IPAB, a government panel called the Independent Payment Advisory Board. Do you feel strongly that one would be better or worse for patients and for Medicare cost control than the other?
Well, I think that when you're talking about premium support, the idea of that Ryan is championing, it's an idea that says, wait a second, you can actually still keep the Medicare public option as one of your choices, but if other providers are offering a better service at lower cost, then you can choose that provider instead. And that's something that is going to tend to lead to this migration that will put pressure on the existing system or indeed on other providers. And I tend to think that that's going to work a little bit better because here's the thing. There are all kinds of ideas for how we might restrain costs, but those ideas aren't necessarily going to come from this agency. Those ideas might come from some small town in Wisconsin where some innovative provider has come up with a whole host of new ideas that or it could come from any number of places. And so when you decentralize that process, you have a trial and error process where a lot of institutions can learn at the same time, make mistakes, get better, get smarter, as you see in any market.
I'm not sure about which would be better for cost control, but I will admit my deep distrust of the insurance companies in terms of which would be better for the patients. I mean, I've seen in my own family, and probably you have, and most people have, how the insurance companies try to deny benefits wherever they can. The older people I know on Medicare are more satisfied with the treatment than they get than are my younger peers on private insurance. And doctors, I think, tend to say that they would rather deal with the Medicare bureaucracy than fight the sharks at the insurance companies to get approval for the tests and the treatments that they want to provide their patients. Is your understanding different from that?
It is different from that, partly because I think that the way that a lot of private insurance providers work is in response to the regulations that are posed on them that govern their behavior. And I think that one place where you see a lot of progress is in the rise of integrated providers. That is, these agencies in which you have salaried physicians who are so that the insurer and the provider are one and the same, and they can cooperate, and they don't have these misaligned incentives, but rather they're working together to provide the best quality of care. And I think that we're basically going to see the rise of integrated providers regardless of the way the payment system looks overall. And I think that that's going to represent a tremendous amount of progress.
One other thing about the question of whose vision is radical. The Ryan proposal to end Medicaid and food stamps as federal entitlements for poor people and just give block grants to the states. Doesn't history suggest we would then see a race to the bottom with most states, you know, shrinking those safety nets so Americans don't move there for benefits? And doesn't it suggest a bad future for the disproportionately black and Latino poor in America who are seen as undeserving by too much of white America?
You know, I don't think that's right. I think that when you look over time, there are a couple of different visions. One vision in which households become more affluent because household income growth is higher, and one vision in which you have a permanent underclass of people who are poor and who need to be sustained by these benefits. And I think that Ryan, and again, not everyone agrees that his vision will get there, but he wants to achieve a vision in which you accelerate economic growth and household income growth so that fewer people depend on those safety net programs over time. And those who do can be sustained by programs that are smaller and more efficient and more effective.
That assumes that old-fashioned trickle-down economics, giving the benefits to the people at the top, even without changing the revenue stream to the federal government under his tax program, would result in more economic growth than the amount that they're cutting out of programs.
Well, I actually don't think it's trickle-down economics at all, Brian. I think that what you're actually talking about is bottom-up entrepreneurial growth. When you put fewer barriers in the way of new startups, and we've seen a historically low number of those in recent years, I mean, there's been a steep drop-off. When you see
barriers being Medicaid and food stamps for working poor?
Oh, absolutely not, but rather a wider panoply of things. When you look at regulations, when you look at a very complicated tax code that is a deterrent to new startups, and also when you look at compliance costs being higher than ever for firms, as you see an accretion of regulatory costs, those are things that actually will diminish job growth over time and in particular household income growth over time. You know, it is an idea that is an idea that not everyone shares, but the idea is that when you allow people to flourish, when you allow people to build large scalable businesses, that's something that is actually going to be very, very beneficial. And that's not trickle down, rather that's a vision in which you have trickle up, in which you have more people who become entrepreneurs, who become successful, and who also are able to hire.
One last thing on Ryan Care and Obamacare. I've mentioned here several times, and I'm curious to get your take on it, that in a way, Ryan Care is Obamacare and Obamacare is Ryan Care. Because Ryan, what's so radical about Ryan Care is that for the elderly, he would have a pool of exchanges and people going out and buying their own insurance and subsidized based on their means. Well, Obamacare is for the uninsured, having an exchange with various private insurance options and government subsidies for the individuals. And both the younger people under Obamacare and the older people under Ryan Care have an individual mandate. They have to go out and buy their insurance, don't they?
Oh, that's actually not quite right. So when you're looking at the Medicare system and how the Medicare system changes, it's actually a public program that where the amount of money that's spent is actually on the books. Whereas when you create something like an individual mandate, what you're saying is that I am commanding you on pain of a civil penalty to purchase insurance, and that is actually not on the books. That is, the money that you yourself are spending under command is not counted as a tax payment. So that is actually a very big difference, though of course it seems somewhat subtle. And actually the key thing that you do there is you make the program look smaller because you're saying, hey, they're spending their own money to do it rather than spending tax money to do it.
On the books, meaning that the subsidies that the elderly would get for their Medicare policy purchases under Ryan Care comes from that dedicated stream of the payroll tax?
That's exactly right. So, for example, when President Clinton proposed a health reform proposal, the payments that went to his version of exchanges were counted as tax payments. And that made President Clinton's health proposal look much more expensive than President Obama's proposal because those payments were not counted as taxes. So that was actually very politically important. Don't count them as taxes. Count them as payments to insurance providers so that it is off the books.
Raihan Salam, columnist at The Daily and blogger for National Review Online's The Agenda. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And tomorrow we'll get another view, as I said, on some of these same things from Chris Hayes from The Nation magazine and MSNBC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, WNYC reporter Beth Fertig, our education reporter, on Chancellor Walcott at 1 year. A few other issues that you teachers, students, and parents may be interested in now that you're all home for the holidays, and Beth's search for photos of principals' offices. Stay with us.